Hi, this is Claudia Cornwall, and I'm inviting you to listen as I discuss my new book, At the World's Edge, Kurt Lang's Vancouver, 1937 to 1998, with writer and podcaster Michael Boxall. At the World's Edge tells the story of a man and a city. Kurt Lang, who was a friend of mine, was a legend in Vancouver, a beatnik, poet, painter, photographer, beachcomber, fisherman, and software entrepreneur. He met Malcolm Lowry and became friends with Al Purdy, Peter Trower, John Newlove, Jamie Reed, artists Fred Douglas, David Marshall, and Roy Cayuca, and musician Al Neal. He became a street photographer in the early 1970s and fished the coast in his 30s, then later developed hardware and software for the railroad industry that is today used all over North America. Kurt's life energetically parallels the evolving history of Vancouver, from the hip subculture years to the electronic postmodern 1990s. I've been a freelance writer for more than 20 years. I've written many magazine articles and four books: The Life and Art of Frank Molnar, Jack Hardman, and Leroy Jensen, Letter from Vienna, A Daughter Uncovers Her Family's Jewish Past, Printouts, The Adventures of a Rebel Computer, and At the World's Edge. Letter from Vienna won the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize in British Columbia for 1996. Michael Boxall is most recently the author of The Great Firewall, now available at Amazon.com. Mother Tongue Publishing is a small literary publisher from Salt Spring Island that is making big waves with its daring publishing program and award-winning books. Its series of books about the unheralded artists of BC is attracting much attention, and its novel Everything Was Goodbye by Gurjinder Basran won the 2011 BC Book Prize for Best Fiction. Here we go.
Claudia, hello.
Hi.
You said at the end of the book that Kurt Lang went through Vancouver like a great wind.
Mm-hmm.
Who was he?
Who was he? Well, that's what I spent the whole book trying to figure out, really. He was so many different things, and people saw him in so many different ways. Some people saw him as a great lover. Other people thought he was not a great lover. Some people thought he was remarkably able. One of the things, he was able in many ways, but he was not so good at making money. And so something, you know, that loomed large for some people. Other people saw more his creativity and his inventiveness. So there were many, you know, he was so many different things to so many different people.
A bunch of different guys.
Yes, yes, I think he was. Yeah. Many, I mean, there were continuities too. I mean, when he started his businesses, for example, he often turned to old friends. He turned to his brother. He didn't start his life from scratch each time he decided on a new venture.
Yeah.
When he log salvaged, he was log salvaging with his brother, among other people. When he started a software company, one of his early software ventures, he turned to Greg, his brother, to help him with that. So he wasn't like a person who totally, you know, burnt all his bridges behind him every time he started something new. There was a continuity there.
Yeah.
And with Gordon, he worked with my husband for about a dozen years, and they worked in a couple of companies together. So, you know, he did, you know, draw on those. Oh, and his friend, Fred Douglas, with whom he became friends when he was 20, remained a very good friend to the end of his life. So there were, you know, some continuities as well as the discontinuities.
Do you remember the first time you met him?
I don't really. I do remember when, you know, that Gordon got a job and started working there. And I think the first time we met must have been that Kurt invited us over for dinner. I expect that was the first time, but I don't remember it exactly.
What was your first impression?
My first impression was I saw him as a businessman because my husband was working for him as a programmer. So, and he was talking about his business and what they were going to do. I thought he was your average businessman. Well, I learned after a while that wasn't quite the case. Yeah, he had this past, this, you know, beatnik, poet, painter, boat builder past that gradually came out. Yeah, I mean, not that he tried to conceal it in any way, but gradually you'd start to hear stories about these past lives that were so interesting.
He certainly seems to have made a strong impression on people.
Oh yes, I think people would not forget him. He was very engaging, and he knew so much about so many different fields that he could engage with almost anybody. And that was one of his successes, or one of the reasons why he was successful in his ventures, was he could engage with people and they would talk to him and he would learn things from them. And this is an anecdote I mentioned in the book. I had once he came over for dinner, and we had an elderly friend over for dinner, an elderly lady from Indiana. And I thought, oh my God, what are these two going to talk about? Because they're so different. Turned out that he knew quite a bit about the founding of the state of Indiana. She was a history buff. They chatted away merrily through the dinner, and he thought she was, you know, they got along tremendously. And I thought, that was not what I would have expected. So he, because he had read a lot, he could sort of, he would find out what people were interested in, and he would hone in on that and learn something from them, from their expertise or their field of knowledge.
Yeah. Yes, he wasn't always a pleasant guy, was he?
No, he wasn't. Some people really didn't like him. He could be insulting sometimes, yeah. Especially when he was young. I mean, I think he became mellower, and perhaps the necessity of, you know, being in business where you had to have employees, you had to keep them happy, you had to keep shareholders happy, it knocked a few of the sharper edges off. But certainly when he was young, he could be, if he thought you were full of shit, he would say so. And he didn't feel that he had to pull his punches, I think, when he was young. I didn't see that so much. I think that he had mellowed to some extent, and perhaps he wasn't, you know, so super convinced of himself. He was a pretty confident guy, but he made some mistakes. He realized he didn't know everything, so he didn't necessarily get on people's nerves the same way, I think. But certainly it was something that that people who knew him when he was younger certainly said that he was quite, could be very abrasive.
You quote Howard White as saying he's the most brilliant and the most unpleasant person he's
ever met. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And Howard doesn't remember exactly why he thought that when he talked to me about that, or he wrote to me about that. He felt that he was perhaps they had a one of Howard's early books was a reprint of a dictionary of Chinook jargon. And this was a venture that he and Kurt cooked up together. He felt somehow that, although he couldn't remember the details, that he had somehow been cheated in this venture, and so he wasn't happy with the way things went. He couldn't remember the details. It's a long time ago. But he had this sort of vaguely, you know, sort of memory of, you know, something unpleasant, a person who was unpleasant, yeah.
He did seem to have something self-destructive about him. I mean, the bookstore venture, for example.
Yes, oh, yeah.
Where he doesn't speak to the customers who come
That's
to the
right.
bookstore.
That's right. He did. He was, especially I think when he was younger, he was quite uncompromising. And I don't know why he started the bookstore venture, because obviously if you think about it for a few minutes, you know, you realize you're going to have to serve customers. I mean, I guess he imagined they'd all be, you know, these very philosophical people who would wander in and he'd have these wonderful conversations with everybody. And then it turned out that, you know, people were not so wonderful. I mean, it was a gamut who came into the store or whatever. Yeah, no, the bookstore, there were other things going on at the time of the bookstore that I think put him into a kind of a foul humor. I mean, he had his relationship with his first wife. He had broken up with her. I think there were other things that were kind of, and he was very unhappy about that. And that was quite devastating for him. I mean, Fred said it was a devastating experience. So I think there were other things going on besides the books itself, but I guess he didn't think it through about what was necessary to run a bookstore, and it just seemed to be tedious to him. Don McLeod, who took over the bookstore, was astonished at his good fortune. I mean, he felt that he had really lucked out, because he paid, like, you know, he took out a loan of $200 or something from the credit union to buy the bookstore, and he made that back in his first day. He thought this was, you know, he'd hit a gold mine. And Don McLeod was someone who was good at making money and who saw opportunities, and he was focused on that and worked hard, without a doubt. He told me that he, you know, every morning he would go to the Sally Ann and see what had turned up in case there were some, you know, interesting books and so on. And I don't think Kurt would have done that, would have been that. I mean, he did work. He was capable of working very, very hard. His second wife told me that when he was fishing, he would work to exhaustion and come home and then sleep for a week. So he was, and I know that when he was running the tech companies and trying to get them off the ground, he worked very hard. He didn't take weekends off. He wasn't a slacker, but the sort of humdrum kind of thing that, you know, go every morning to the Sally Ann and see whether, you know, some wonderful book had turned up. Yeah. You get bored with that after a while.
Yeah, not long after that, people were throwing money out of airplanes by the $100,000 for him.
Oh, yes,
so
yes.
He must have inspired some trust in some.
Yes, certainly with the fishing, I mean, that was a crazy time. I mean, there was so much money to be made and people would... It wasn't just him. I mean, there was like millions of dollars were passing around, and then Prince Rupert or that area was benefiting tremendously from this huge influx of money, and the Japanese were prepared to spend almost any sum, it seemed, for, you know, herring roe or whatever they were interested in. So there was a huge amount of money floating around. And yes, he did, you know, Kurt was honest. He was a fair boss when Gordon was dealing with him. He never kind of made... He didn't seem to take out more money than anybody else. He was kind of fair. He just divided it all up. He was not that interested in making money. He was interested in creating things and doing things. Money was not top priority for him.
I think you quote Jamie Reed as saying that aesthetics was his driving force.
Aesthetics was very important. I mean, when he was developing the range camera, which was a device, it was kind of an interesting camera that you could take measurements that would measure things. It would capture shapes and measure things. So it was used, BC Rail bought one to measure the railroad track for various purposes, to see whether it was safe or whether the rail needed replacing. So this was a very, you know, highly technical, industrial use camera. But he had high aesthetic standards about how it should be. And I think that's true. I mean, he liked lines to be clean, and his drawings of boats, for instance, when he was doing that, are very clean, very spare. The way he lived, his apartment was quite spare. He didn't have a lot of extra furniture. He tended to get rid of stuff. He didn't want a lot of things around. He had this kind of spare aesthetic. He was always telling Gordon, who worked for him as a programmer, to, you know, cut the scope. Don't make things complicated. Don't overcomplicate a program. Just do what it, you know, make it do what it has to do, but don't get, you know, and this was partly, you know, to make something that a customer wouldn't have to pay too much for, but it was also his aesthetic. He wanted something simple and elegant. Yeah, he didn't like things. He didn't like ornament. Yeah.
Somewhat like Steve Jobs, in fact.
Maybe so. Yes, yeah, yeah.
Similar kind of aesthetic applied to technology.
Yes, right. He didn't like things too complicated, as, you know, as simple as possible, and just do what it has to do and not all sorts of other things. Yeah. Mm.
The book is called At the Edge of the World.
At the World's Edge.
At the World's Edge, I think. Yeah. At the World's Edge.
Yeah.
So that seems to apply to Vancouver as well as to Kurt himself.
That's right. And it is a line from a poem that he wrote when he was about 20 in Montreal. And that seemed to pull all those things together. I mean, he lived close to the edge. He was willing to risk a great deal, and... So that was partly why I wanted to call it that. And his poem, which is 1956, he said, from the black pool sky, bottomless dropped, fell away into the charred mirror of the brackish water, the wood pool clogged with twigs in the November dusk, unnaturally still, pictured the evening's nakedness of trees. A gull passed in the sky with the same distant motion, another in the pool. I saw then at the world's edge that the sky's heaven had borne a daughter, and that the hawks and herons who draw the sky around them are too the dolphins of this other air. There at my wish's window I leaned out, complete but for wings and toppling at the brink of flight. And I think, you know, that expresses something about Kurt, too, that, you know, there at my wish's window, I leaned out. I mean, he was always kind of leaning out and starting something new.
Yeah. I thought from the first part of the book, it's very much a memoir of a particular kind of milieu and time,
mm-hmm.
50s and 60s mm-hmm. Vancouver.
Yes.
Which seems to me, I wasn't here at that time, it's an alien land to me. It seems very different from what the city is like now. Do you think he reflected something because he was born in that time and in this place that perhaps would not have come out if he'd been born 20 years later or something like that?
I think so. I mean, the beatnik period,
yeah.
I think he was certainly quite, it seemed to me he was immersed in that beatnik period and the lifestyle, and I think, and it's hard to imagine him, you know, living in any other city. He was very much a Vancouver person. He, with his, his love of the sea and his use of the sea in various occupations, he was building boats. Even at the end of his life, he was building small boats. I think that was all through him. So I think the time and the place were certainly very much him. And that's one of the things that I thought was interesting about writing a book about him was that you could kind of see the history of Vancouver through looking at his life. I mean, from the beatnik period to the period where resources were so important, the log salvaging, the boat building, the fishing, all of those things came through, and then into high tech. I mean, it's a mirror of his life. It kind of mirrors the history of the city. But certainly he was definitely a West Coast person. He was, one of the interesting things about him was that after the war, he lived in the Vancouver Hotel, because the Vancouver Hotel had been turned into, or a number of veterans had seized the Vancouver Hotel and turned it into a hostel, and he lived there with his father, who was a veteran, and his mom. And so, you know, I think, you know, that's sort of an interesting aside, too. But that's, you know, very much. And he was very familiar with downtown. I mean, he grew up when he was living in the Vancouver Hotel. He was, you know, chasing around on his bike in downtown Vancouver. And so he was. And then this whole, I mean, Fred said when they did that photography project together, Kurt was absolutely obsessed. I mean, he took 12,000 photographs. It's an immense collection, which is in the Vancouver Special Collections and the Vancouver Library Special Collections. But Fred said it was as if he had been let loose in his dreams. I mean, because he was so familiar with Vancouver, with downtown Vancouver. It was just, he knew what pictures to take, and he had a great affinity with his subject.
Was that his first venture into photography?
Yes. I mean, his first major venture, yeah. And like the other things he did, I think Bill Jeffries observed this, that he picked up a camera and he just started to take pictures. I mean, he had seen what other people had done and had some views about what pictures were good and what he wanted to do. He was clear that he wanted to take pictures of ordinary people doing ordinary things, just the regular life that was being lived at that time. So he was very clear about that, but he just, you know, picked up the camera and started taking pictures. And those days, I mean, they did all the developing themselves. So he figured all that out and the chemicals to use. He didn't, you know, take the pictures to London Drugs and get them developed. He had to do it all himself. He didn't have a dark room, but he used his friend Rod Gillingham had a dark room. And then he even figured out some way of developing en masse using pipes and, you know, just so that you could, because he was taking so many pictures, he wanted to be able to do it quickly. And so he figured out some way of mechanizing, but anyway, speeding up the process.
Did he seem to be a kind of speedy person when you were talking to him, when you were with him? Was he kind of restless and
agitated? No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say he was restless. He would, you know, sit in a chair for, you know, a long time, especially if he had a glass of wine in his hand. Say that he was, you know, physically restless, no, but he was always in his mind restless and always wanting to go on to the next thing and always having ideas. But physically, no. I mean, when he was younger, he was quite thin, he was slim. When I met him, he was kind of a stocky fellow, solid looking. did not seem like, you know, a flighty type.
When did you get the idea of writing a book about him?
I guess I got it. Well, I had an idea before, you know, a few years before he died, and we had no inkling that, I mean, he became sick in September of 1998 and died in December, so this was a very quick illness. So, but a few years before that, when all was well, I had the idea of writing a book about him just because he'd done so many different things, and I thought his life was quite unique and that he was quite unique, and he said to me, well, I'm not dead yet. So that kind of backed off because I thought, well, it doesn't sound like he's too enthusiastic about this. So then when he died, I thought, well, okay, now he is dead yet, so I can go ahead and do it. And so I began to do interviews, and I interviewed some of the people I knew, some of his friends that I had already met, like Fred. And I also interviewed other people that I had never met, like Don McLeod, who has since died, but I was able to talk to him. And David Marshall, the sculptor, also has died, but I was able to talk to him. So I went around and interviewed his friends, his colleagues, people who knew him. And then I wrote about three quarters of the book and tried to find a publisher, and I had no luck at all. And so I thought, oh, okay, I guess no one's interested in this. I just stuck it in a drawer. And then Mona Fertig, last fall, which was October of 2010, she sent me an email. She was interested in publishing this manuscript because I had known Mona since she started the Literary Storefront, so that was in the 70s, known her a long time, and she knew that I had worked on this project and that it had never really got finished, but that I had worked on it. And she had been doing a series, publishing a series of books. It's called The Unheralded Artists of BC. Not that Kurt is an unheralded artist. He did lots of things, but he was an artist and other things as well. But anyway, one of the books in the series was a book that she wrote about her father, George Fertig. And in that book, she mentioned Kurt just briefly because George and Kurt were friends or acquaintances. And then George Fetherling wrote a review of Mona's book in the Vancouver Sun. And he said, one of the things he said, it was a flattering review or favorable review. One of the things he said was that it's nice to see people like Kurt being remembered in books now. And so Mona thought, when she read that, she thought, ah, I'm going to get this book published. So that's how it all came about. Astonished me.
What did you learn during your research about Kurt that you hadn't known when?
Well, there were lots of things that I learned. I mean, I found, I read the correspondence between Kurt and Al Purdy. I knew that he had been a friend of Al Purdy's, but I didn't know very much about it, and he hadn't talked a lot about it. They became less good friends. They didn't see each other much when I knew him. So that was interesting. I mean, I found Greg, Kurt's brother, gave me the correspondence, that is the letters that Al had written to Kurt. And then I found in the University of Saskatchewan archives, I found the letters that Kurt had written to Al. So that was interesting. It was kind of fun to see that, and they were both very lively correspondents and very definite opinions about everything, which made it interesting. I found, and there's a famous episode where Kurt was, Malcolm Lowry read some of his poems and said that they were, said this was maybe the work of a genius. It's a very famous story about Kurt. And I had all these poems that Kurt had written. But I didn't know which ones were the work of a genius or the ones that Malcolm Lowry had seen. But then again, I was able to find the poems at UBC. That was kind of fun because his letters and his papers are all, a lot of it is at UBC. So the poems that Kurt had sent to him were there, and so I could read them. That was fun. I found out, you know, a lot of details about his life that I hadn't known. I met his first wife, and that was interesting. She was a very shadowy figure. And the first time when I initially did the research, I had not found her because she didn't use the same last name. I mean, I didn't know what last name she was using, whether it was her maiden name or Lang or had she got married. And so I had trouble. I couldn't find her. But this time, the second time around, when Mona said, let's go ahead, let's do the book, then I did some more research and I was able to find her. So that was interesting. I think, and it just deepened my sense that, you know, here was a man who, I said in the end of the book that he shows us, you know, the power of choice. Like he just would choose to do something, and maybe he didn't know a lot about it or hadn't studied it, but he would choose to do it and he would do it. I think he gave you a sense reading this, or, you know, doing the research and learning more about his life, you know, gave me the sense that, you know, we can do more than we think we can. I mean, people often have this sort of narrow view, and you can just, if you follow him, you can kind of do a lot of different things. I mean, he was very much a self-made, self-taught person. He would, he didn't finish school. He quit towards the end of grade 12. And after that, he did take a welding course, but he never took any other courses. He just, if he wanted to know something, he would get a book. He would talk to people who knew something about the subject, and he would just go ahead and do it. He couldn't decide to do this. He took heroin, then he stopped taking heroin. I mean, he was just able to do he would experiment. He would, and I think that's kind of encouraging, because I think these days people often have the feeling you have to specialize, you have to kind of develop a lot of expertise about one little tiny area of life, and that wasn't his way. And so I think it's an interesting model that, you know, it's possible to be like that.
What do you think he'd be doing now if he was still alive?
I think he would be in a boat, probably mucking around up the coast, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, when he started IMI, which was his last company, he said to Gordon, I think this will be my last company. And we often wondered whether that was, you know, a prophetic remark. But before that, while he was sort of working on it, he said to Gordon, you know, I'd still like to go up the coast, you know. So I think he would have, you know, got a boat and he'd be up somewhere, you know, Euclid or something like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay.
And
well, thank you.
Good luck with the book.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah.